Good morrow and welcome to the realm. I am epic fantasy author J.B. Hilliard, your friendly neighborhood scribe. And for those of you marking your first adventure into my realm, this is a vast and sweeping domain where I feature a variety of creatives on a weekly basis that specialize in a variety and a plethora of art forms. And as always, if you like what you hear, you can find me and my epic and dark fantasy books at jbhilliard.com, or you can follow me at jbhilliardbooks on Twitter/X, whatever it's called these days, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube, or look for me as J.B. Hilliard on Facebook and Discord. So as we reach our witching hour, let me cast my message spell and take control of the magical airwaves of Blog Talk Radio. And for you Dungeons & Dragons nerds out there, the duration of my transmutation spell here is about 30 minutes. So set your sundials and let's enter the realm together. Today, I will be chronicling the adventures of a fellow speculative fiction scribe, Phil Athens. Phil's an editor. He's a writer himself, and we'll get into some of that. And he's also done some work for Wizards of the Coast and the D&D brands. Phil, well met, and welcome to the realm.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, tell our listeners about you, what you write, what you do, and where they can find you.
So I'm mostly right now a freelance editor, which you can find me at athensassociates.com. But I also write about writing at Fantasy Authors Handbook, which is fantasyhandbook.wordpress.com, all these ridiculously long URLs that seemed like a good idea at the time. But that's also branching out into a Fantasy Authors Handbook YouTube channel, where I've just set up a Goodreads group. So I'm out there talking about the art and craft of writing fantasy, science fiction, horror in particular, but fiction in general. And I did, you know, I have been working in the publishing industry in one way or another as an author, editor, since so long ago that it just seems like it must have been really 100 years ago, but it was more like, 36 or 37 years, including 15 years, first at TSR, then Wizards of the Coast, where I ended up as senior managing editor for book publishing.
So let's spend a little time familiarizing ourselves, our listeners, with that, because you know, many of our Wizards of the Coast and current D&D folks might not even know what TSR was or is. How did you find your way into TSR? That's like a dream job for many of us nerds out here.
Oh, I mean, forget about it. It was for me too, right? I mean, I started, you know, playing sort of like science fiction board games, you know, that kind of stuff as when I was really just sort of in junior high, which was X millions of years ago, and discovered D&D in the summer of 1978, right before I started high school, and then went into high school and met a few other people who had been playing it as well. And just, that was it, man. I just descended into that. And that was how I spent all of high school and a good part of college and then several years after that, right? And growing up in suburban Chicago, at that time, in the very early age, you know, very early years of D&D, it was still a very Midwestern thing. TSR, which was the company that Gary Gygax set up to publish D&D, was based in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, which was about 50 miles north of us. It was exactly 54 miles, I learned, as I started to make that daily commute when I actually started working there in September of 95. And to get that job to me was just... I mean, that was it. I mean, that was just the holy grail of jobs, really. To be involved in book publishing, which was, you know, sort of my co-love at the time with, you know, D&D and other role-playing games, and to sort of mix those two into a job at what at the time was by far the biggest, the first... was the dream job, and it stayed that way for 15 years. I was at TSR only for about 2 years before we ended up moving out to Seattle, thanks to the great superhero Peter Atkinson in Wizards of the Coast.
So I, as a D&D guy myself, I've got to ask the dumbest question of all time. I'm sure you get this on a lot of your shows. But, you know, I know you're also a writer, right? And by the way, I might be showing my age a little bit here, but I loved Annihilation. I know we, you and I have had that conversation offline. It's one of my favorites. So was, that's a big favorite of mine. But, you know, have you ever baked into any of your novels or any of your writing any of your D&D characters, whether as a dungeon master or a player, and made them characters in your novels?
Yes and no. So after, or as third edition was just coming out, I was at TSR and Wizards for three different editions of D&D, right? Starting with second edition all the way through third, and, you know, ending with fourth edition. And just as third edition was coming out, or a little bit after, they wanted to do sort of a third edition D&D novel line that was just D&D. And it was all kind of set up without me a little bit. And then I was sort of brought, okay, like, now you go actually make this real in some way. And they had set up a house name where everybody was, there was just sort of one author, but a number of authors were sort of assigned to different books. And it was taking those third edition example characters that you saw through, you know, the Player's Handbook and DM's Guide for third edition, Regdar and all those guys. And the idea was, we're just going to sort of create a D&D world separate from the Forgotten Realms and Greyhawk and everything else. And it was sort of like, just go and just do it as fast as possible. Use these characters starting at first level, and then they sort of would level up as the series went. I was assigned to the first one and needed a city. So the city in that book was the city from my homebrew D&D campaign from when I was in high school.
Easy. And I'm sure that's a monster Easter egg for all your friends too.
I know, right? I mean, I wonder how many of them, some I haven't talked to in, I mean, literally, you know, 30 years, 40 years even. But yeah, that was the city. New Croatia was the sort of central city of my formative D&D campaign.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that, because, you know, I'm the same way. Like, my novels, I've baked a number of my adventures in and knitted into the structure of it, you know, characters and such. And I do leave that. But I will have to say this as a funny sidebar. Like, when I get together, like holidays and or birthday parties for kids, and you're with families, and all my D&D nerd buddies are there, our wives look at us like we got our heads screwed on wrong when we're talking about what they describe to us as like group delusions. Like, we're talking about adventures that happen, like they actually happen in real life. And they're looking at us like, what are you guys talking about? And they're like, this happened this past Sunday at 6 o'clock, you know? And it's just something that transcends. So it stays with you. And I'm certain that they would remember that in the same way you remember that. And you've kind of been able to memorialize that in your writing, which I think is like really, really cool. But, you know, if you don't mind, let's switch subjects for a second. I'd love to talk, because you mentioned at the top a little bit about not only your fantasy author's writer's guide, but also your YouTube channel. And I think that most of our listeners fall into two categories. They're mostly readers and or they're authors. And I think they might benefit from both of those as a resource. Can you go into a little bit more detail about both of them?
Sure. So the YouTube channel has only just started up, and right now all you'll find out, not all, right, because I put a lot of effort into this, but is sort of BookTube content, right? I am a collector of books as well, a lot of vintage science fiction, and I sort of collect by series and stuff like that. So I bought a box of books from eBay, like 95 of them, just a giant collection of mostly science fiction books. And in a series of four videos, I go through each one of the ones from the box and talk about where they came from, which ones I've already read, which ones I have already. So you can find that at the Fantasy Authors Handbook YouTube channel. So that's really just starting, but more content on the way for sure. I'm going to be recording a lot of what are essentially tutorial videos, or just sort of discussion videos, opinion videos, things like that about the craft of writing, what's, you know, sort of the most important aspect of it, and just sort of discussing the art and craft of writing altogether. And then the blog, which has been going since June of 2009, so it's really long-running, every single Tuesday religiously, that has covered enormous territory, and I'm starting to collect those in books. The first one is out already, that sort of the better posts from 2009 to 2013. And the next one, I'm trying to get out by the end of the year. It probably won't make it, but it should be, you know, soon after the beginning of 2024. Volume 2 will cover 2014 to 16, probably. So there's an enormous amount of material there that, you know, is finally going to be collected in a way that is lots more accessible and also revised and updated. So it's not just, you know, all references and examples that are 10 years old already. And that sort of came from when I was still working at TSR. One of the guy used to be my boss there, actually, had left the company, started working for Adams Media, which is a big nonfiction publisher. And he came to me saying they want to put out a book about writing fantasy. Do you want to do it? And I was like, sure. You know, so I did. And at first, the original title was Fantasy Author's Handbook. And I set up the blog to sort of premiere and, you know, talk about and set the stage for that book. And then eventually they're like, no, add science fiction too, right? Because that can just be compressed into one book. Why not? Like, oh, sure.
Well, yeah, so, right. I mean, they're kind of adjacent, right?
They're semi-adjacent, sure. So it became The Guide to Writing Fantasy and Science Fiction. And that came out in, I want to say, 2010, yeah. And, you know, then I did another book for Writer's Digest book called Writing Monsters. So that's still, both of those are still out there. And I just kept up with this blog. Like, once I get into that kind of habit, not even a kind of habit, absolutely a habit of every Tuesday I have to come up with something at least semi-valuable to say on there. I've just been plugging away at that and talking about writing until I'm blue in the face.
Well, you know, let's delve into that a little bit. But before I do, I do have to say something. I had a guest on a few months ago named Leslie Summers, and she told me when I was at a GalaxyCon that if you collect 1,000 books, you can officially apply for like library status. And you know, my wife didn't want to hear that, but I'm like you. I collect a lot of books. I have this strange OCD thing where I buy a paperback copy and I'll read it. And if I like the book, I'll go out and get the hardback and then just put it on a shelf and never touch it. Like it's a pristine, like I can't even open a page, you know, that kind of stuff. It's more like a collector's thing. Sounds like you and I really think on the same path towards our own libraries. But since you mentioned the editing stuff and how this handbook would help, do you find it hard as a professional editor to allow someone else to edit your work? I mean, have you ever disagreed with their assessments, or have you ever said, you know, I got to find a new editor for my stuff, or you do you try to put a division of church and state there and say, look, you know, hey, I brought them on as a professional to do this to help me. Right. Where do you find that line, and is it ever blurred?
No, honestly, well, first of all, you never have to agree with everything. And, you know, I'm delighted when authors that I work with push back on anything, you know, let's talk about it. And if in the end, it's just, well, I like it better that way, then fantastic, right? It's your book. It's not my book. But, and I do carry that through, you know, my relationship with editors as well. As an editor, I absolutely always value what an editor brings to the table, and I know I can't do it without one. So, you know, I'm absolutely delighted to work with an editor. And here's the thing, you know, all of the stuff that I immediately identify in other authors' writing, and I work with a lot of authors really at the beginning of their career when there's still a lot of craft stuff to get through. I can just immediately spot, yeah, this, that, the other thing, right? And I'm just marking this like, yep, everybody does that. It's okay. You know, it's easily fixable. And then when I get an edit back, I've done all of those things myself. So I don't think that there is a way, at least if there is, in 30-plus years, I haven't found it, to meld those two brains together and edit yourself and not just write in words like I just said, just, which tends to be everywhere in everything that I write. So I need an editor for the writing that I do before it goes out there. Absolutely.
So, you know, you mentioned before that you're a collector, so I got to go back to this a little bit. Have you ever collected an author that in the beginning you might not have liked, but you thought maybe, you know, peer pressure, like, hey, I've got to mm-hmm. you know, collect this person, and end up growing to love their work? Has it ever been that way, or the opposite way, where, you know, you started loving an author and then you just got tired of their work and ended up not following them anymore? Yeah, mm-hmm. And you don't have to give me the names. I just want to know if you did.
No, I have, through my entire life, and literally since I was a kid, have gone through these weird cycles where I latch on to an author and just binge like crazy until, you know, I think anything that you love, you can just, it's enough already at some point, right? That, you know, like as a kid, I just adored Ray Bradbury and just kept reading until finally I just couldn't anymore. I went through a similar period with Ian Banks, another period with J.G. Ballard that I've now kind of gotten, you know, it's like you have to rest for a second and then you can get back to the rest of those, especially authors with huge catalogs, which, you know, is something that I think is lost these days. You don't have authors like somebody like Robert Silverberg or Mac Reynolds, you know, who's just got dozens and dozens and dozens of novels, 4 or 5 published in a year and things like that, that you can almost never keep up. I don't think you would have to kind of devote a large portion of your life to reading Robert Silverberg. So, you know, I kind of recognize that point where it's like, okay, kind of enough already, that's overload. And so I can set those aside and then come back in.
Well,
but a lot of my collecting.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, finish your thought.
No, a lot of my collecting stuff is really about nostalgia at this point. It's a sort of recapturing of my youth, or, you know, like I always, when I was a little kid, I always looked at the Perry Rhodan series as like this aspirational thing, which is very strange. If you've ever read one of them, it's actually not good. The translation is super clunky.
Yeah.
But I always just thought, God, there's this long, huge series that just goes on, and they're just kind of cool and fun to have. Wouldn't that be cool and fun to have? And then just like, I don't know, 15 years ago or so, I happened to find the first and second book in a used bookstore, and I was like, well, I can't not buy these, right? And then there's just something that
they're got to have, right? Yeah.
Collector OCD brain, without reading a word of either of those, it was like, now I have to have these. I have to have all of these. I actually found it, I walked into a used bookstore and they just had a huge shelf full of them. And I asked one of the booksellers, like, can we make a deal? Like, and I ended up buying them for $1 each. There were 92 of them. And I was just like, and my wife was with me looking at me like I'm an insane person, which is not
like, how are you going to put them in the car?
Yeah.
You're like, well, you're taking the bus home. Grab an Uber.
Yeah, like, what are you doing? Like, uh-oh, like, here he goes again. I don't know. And she said something like, how did you even get all these? And the bookseller kind of shrugged. And I said, I don't know, somebody's grandfather died. And she said, yeah, that was probably it. Like, you just have to sort of wait for this collector to, you know, go the way of all flesh. And then eventually you can just load up on Perry Rhodan. So I'm almost complete with that series. I have actually read the first 2 books. They're just a gas. They're just really, really fun. And again, that editor brain clicking in going, God, there's so many ways in which I could just make this better.
alas, it's too late.
But, you know, what the heck? Because I, you know, I'm also, as somebody who sort of writes about writing and teaches writing, it's always hard to find negative examples. I have to tend to make them up, you know, like, here's the way that I see this a lot, and then here's how I would rewrite it. And wanting to be, being somebody who really is always, I try my best anyway, to be positive, 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 especially about books, which I just love. I love everything about them, everyone involved with them. I don't want to be a critic who says this book sucks and here's why. And so it's really hard for me to find an actual example in the wild that I can break down. But the great thing about collecting Perry Rodan and Doc Savage in particular is that I don't feel any guilt about like calling those out and saying,
hey, that's a personal pleasure.
Okay,
you're fine with that stuff. Everybody has one. It's okay.
So I can peel a paragraph out of a Doc Savage book and say, okay, here's what was going on in 1934 with this guy who had to write a 60,000-word novel every month. And he was getting paid by the word. So here's a paragraph from Doc Savage book, and here's how you can make that paragraph into one sentence that says exactly the same thing. So, you know, some of that kind of really old, like pulp era stuff is, for me, a great wellspring of negative examples, but in a really kind of fun way to say. Also, you know, obviously writing and sort of the expected style genre writing has changed a lot in, say, 100 years, 90, 80 years.
So a lot of publishers out there, and I see a lot of this in indie publishing too, there's this new rapid release kind of effort where, you know, trying to catch the attention of, you know, millennials and Gen Zs that have the ability to binge everything that they want. It's an on-demand society, and attention spans are less. So you, as an author, you risk losing them if you don't put out stuff quickly. As an editor, that's got to drive you insane, because I'm certain you're seeing stuff come in that might be good but could be great, and or the rush that the marketplace is forcing. You know, what's your opinion on that trend in publishing these days?
Yeah, I'm trying my best to fight against it, but, you know, the lone voice in the wilderness, because, you know, my experience at Wizards of the Coast in particular, as we really ramped up the publishing business, by the time we got to like 2006-07, we were publishing over 100 books a year, and that was too many, and I would have constant arguments with the sort of business side, just desperately trying to get them to give me more time. They would wait till the very last second to, or beyond the last second, to actually get an author contracted. Books were being written too fast, edited too fast, published too fast. Everything was just content, 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 more, 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 more. And the quality was suffering, and it was just really hard to sort of watch that. And knowing that, you know what, everybody really wants this to be good, right? Authors weren't coming in saying, gee, I hope I publish a really bad book that everybody hates. Everybody's trying to And it's like one more draft and this would be fantastic. And there's just no way to do that. It was just absolutely impossible.
I get that. I just see that.
Like volunteering for that drives me a little bit crazy. Especially, and here's why. Because I have no reason to believe that they're in any way right about that. That hurling content at it somehow is better. And I keep hearing this from mostly kind of semi-anonymous Twitter sources and stuff. Like, this is how the Amazon algorithm wants you to do this. This is how you crack the algorithm. And if you do this, that'll happen. I don't know. I mean, I live 20 miles away from Amazon's headquarters. They're a local company for me. I understand how huge they are, and I don't think a lot of, especially authors and sort of book people, still think of them as the online bookstore. They're like a $2 trillion company, and selling books is a really tiny portion of that. And for anyone to think I have cracked the algorithm is patently absurd. So if you're getting advice from, this is how you get Amazon to move your book up here and there, and you can manipulate Amazon, hilarious. Absolutely not.
The only thing you have control over
as an author is the quality of your own work. Write the best book you can. The great algorithm in the sky is out of your control.
Yeah, I think for everyone that's a listener here, whether they're an author or a reader, I think that's important for them to hear. That's probably the biggest golden nugget they can take away from the show. But speaking of shows, we're in the last 5 minutes of it. So I promised you a lightning round in the beginning. I'm going to throw a lightning round at you now. So these questions are designed to, solicit quick responses, one sentence, one word. But if you stun me, I'm going to stop you. We'll go into it a little bit. But all right, so as a D&D player, what is your favorite race and class to play?
Gnome illusionist. I have a little garden gnome miniature that I've had for like 35 years, and that is my character. He's been like 8 different characters.
Oh, same guy, just reincarnated.
Sort of, yeah. He has a different name, but the same miniature, and he's been spectacular every single time.
Well, there's good karma in there, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. How about this? How about the favorite book that you've ever edited?
Ooh, that's a hard one. That's kind of like saying your favorite child that you've ever raised. But, it's 100% the Warminster series.
Well, clearly, of course. I mean, why would it not? But this office work aside.
How could it be anything else with that?
I don't know. I shouldn't even ask the question. I should have put that aside. So, all right, we'll move on to the next. So if you had to write under a pen name, and I know, and your wink, wink, nod, nod, I know that you have, outside of the one that you've used, what would that pen name be?
I don't know. I haven't really thought of that because there are pen names that I have like I've outed myself as one of the like 8 T.H. Lanes, as G.W. Zerpa, yep. Stuff like that. But, I don't know. That one, I might have to punt that question because I think it someone would have to tell me what name would work best with the Amazon algorithm, and we'll go with that.
Well played. And you could pass like you do in the $25,000 pyramid, not to beat you, but you can pass. All right, so here's a couple of fun ones. So you find yourself in a magical library, but to your surprise, as you enter the stacks, there's only one book on the shelf, and that book can be any book that you can choose from anywhere at any time, but it's only one book. What would that book be for you and why?
First of all, it would have to be a book that I've never read. I tend to – it's extremely rare that I read a book twice. I would say that would be a collection of lost stories by Harlan Ellison that were found in his, in his basement after he died.
All right, that's fair enough. How about this one? You're trapped in a fantasy battle, and you can summon one and only one fantasy hero to come to your rescue. Who would that hero be?
Oh, without hesitation, Conan. He was my introduction to fantasy. 100% Conan the Barbarian.
Fair enough. It's a very good answer, and may Crom be with you. And the last question I've got before we wrap this up is, you find a chest, and in that chest, there's one item from any fantasy series or book that you can keep for your own. What would that item be and why?
Ooh, man, that's a hard one. Let's go with Stormbringer.
Oh, with Elric. You can't beat that, right? Like, that's
but
the one
it,
where...
It steals the souls of anyone it kills, and it would absolutely have to be as painted by Michael Whalen on the old Dell edition of Stormbringer. The coolest.
Fair enough. Well done. I love, and I agree with that. I think that might be my favorite magical item, quote-unquote, and you call that forth, you're just a badass, so... Well, look, Phil, we're coming to the end of the duration of my message spell here, and I can feel the magic fading from my eyes. So before I leave, I want to thank you one more time for being here and tell everyone one last time where they can find you.
You can find me at athensassociates.com or fantasyhandbook.wordpress.com, on Twitter or X or whatever it's going to be called by the time you get there, at Phil Athens, A-T-H-A-N-S. And just look for on YouTube for Fantasy Authors Handbook, the new channel. Subscribe for free, etc.
Thank you again, my friend.
And Google me, you'll find me.
Yeah, And to our followers, thank you again for lending us your ear today. And until next time, I'm JV Hilliard, and may your gods go with you.